All right, here we are, final chapter, which is 31, and it has to do with amino acid synthesis, basically the reverse of what the last chapter was. So instead of breaking them down, we're building them. As we already discussed last time, amino acids, obviously, as aminos, contain nitrogen. And so this is why every organism on Earth vitally requires nitrogen. But ironically, almost no organism on Earth is able to get it from where it's plentiful. You know, the air is full of nitrogen. 80% of the atmosphere is pure nitrogen gas, N2. But there's almost no organisms on Earth that are able to convert that nitrogen gas into biologically usable form of nitrogen. The biologically useful forms of nitrogen are ammonia or ammonium ion, nitrate, nitrite. These things are made from pure nitrogen gas in a process that's called nitrogen fixation. That's analogous to carbon fixation. Carbon fixation is what photosynthetic organisms do, right? They take inorganic carbon in the form of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and incorporate it into organic compounds that we're all made out of. That process is called carbon fixation. Nitrogen fixation takes nitrogen from its biologically useless form, pure nitrogen, and puts it into a biologically useful form for all other organisms to use. So we tend to more often think about the importance of plants, I think, in terms of photosynthesis, which is true. They're really important. They're not the only photosynthetic organisms. But we rely on plants because they are the ones that fix the carbon for us. But even plants can't fix nitrogen. There's only a few species of bacteria, not even all bacteria. A few species of bacteria are able to fix nitrogen, and for that reason, the rest of us exist. We all rely vitally on those bacteria. The nitrogen-fixing bacteria have this special enzyme complex in them, which we're looking at on slide one, called the nitrogenase complex. This is what allows them to fix nitrogen. So this is not in us. Some of the chapter is about what happens in us, but this is in bacteria, and only, like I say, nitrogen-fixing bacteria, which include some cyanobacteria, some sulfur bacteria, and some others that live in symbiotic relationships with plants. Anyway, this nitrogenous complex, as you see, includes two major parts, denoted by the two different colors here, yellow and blue. And they're functionally different. The yellow part is classified as reductase, and the blue as nitrogenase, even though the overall complex, of course, is also called the nitrogenase complex. The reductase is doing exactly what the name implies it's doing. It's receiving electrons. So the fixation of nitrogen requires an input of electrons, and it also requires an input of energy in the form of ATP. Of course, you need hydrogens to make ammonia, right? So you need protons and electrons, really. But they're separate in the process. They will be rejoined in the process of becoming hydrogen atoms again as part of NH3, ammonia. But they come into the enzyme as electrons. And these electrons used for nitrogen fixation come from either oxidation or photosynthesis, depending on the species of bacterium that's able to do this. Like I said, not many are able to do this. What is the big deal? Why is it so difficult to fix nitrogen? Why is nitrogen gas, in other words, N2, so inert? You breathe it in, you just breathe it back out. Nothing happens with it chemically in us. That's exactly right. The valence of nitrogen is 3. It's right next door to carbon on the periodic table, which is tetravalent. So nitrogen has a valence of 3, therefore makes 3 bonds. When 2 nitrogens get together, they gladly make a triple bond between them, and that's what an N2 molecule is. So structurally, you would just write that as 2 N's with a triple bond between them, right? That triple bond is really stable, difficult to break. Although producing ammonia from nitrogen is actually an exergonic process and therefore spontaneous. This is a good indication of the fact that spontaneity does not necessarily mean quickness chemically. You can have a spontaneous reaction that basically takes forever to happen on its own unless you help it out. The reason that most organisms are not able to do this is because even though ammonia has a lower G than N2, and that's why it's exergonic, getting there features very high activation energy. A huge hill to climb. Remember how enzymes work. You have to reduce that activation energy. Well, that's what nitrogenase does in these few bacteria that are able to do this. We can't do it. So we rely on the ammonia that they make. And so, like I said, the electrons that get delivered to the reductase part of the complex come either from oxidation pathways or from photosynthesis, both of which produce electrons that get transferred down electron transport chains, as you already hopefully know. And they're coming in, depending on the species, usually via ferredoxin. Ferredoxin is carrying the electrons and then delivers them to the reductase part of the complex. Also, the reductase part of the complex uses ATP, breaks phosphate off of it in the process of sending those electrons then to the blue part of the complex, which is the nitrogenase part. Notice the other names. Reductase is also called the iron protein. Fe is iron. The blue one, the nitrogenase part, is also called the molybdenum iron protein. MO is molybdenum. All right, so when the electrons reach the nitrogenase part of the complex, then nitrogen gas gets cleaved into 2 nitrogens that receive hydrogen each, and so you make NH3 ammonia. So that has to happen for everyone else to live because we need the usable forms of nitrogen to make our nitrogenous compounds, including all amino acids, all nucleotides, and other nitrogenous compounds. All right, let's look at, in more detail, slide 2. This is just a ribbon diagram of the iron complex, the yellow part of the previous slide. You'll need to be able to draw this ribbon for the test. I'm glad you recognize that as a joke. This just shows you basically that the iron complex features iron cysteine complexes within it that makes it work. This is very similar to stuff we've looked at before. But I just wanted to show you the picture. And slide 3 is a picture of the other part, the molybdenum iron protein, otherwise known as the nitrogenase part of the nitrogenase complex. It has 2 important groups on it, a P cluster, which itself has iron sulfur groups in it, but another part called the molybdenum iron cofactor. And that's where the molybdenum is. That's why it gets its name. And that's the part that actually, where nitrogen fixation actually occurs finally. And you don't no longer have molecular nitrogen, you have a couple molecules of ammonia instead. And of course, ammonia is then usually protonated, since it's a fairly strong acid, it receives the proton and becomes ammonium ion. Okay, so all of that has to happen before anyone can have any, make any amino acids. So this could be happening in us or a bacterium. The assumption here is that we have ammonium to work with, which is on the left. It's a reactant. So once you have the ammonium, then you're well on your way to be able to make amino acids. And doing so is kind of like the reverse of breaking them down, which we discussed in the previous chapter. It's going to involve, although there's 20 amino acids that need to be built, it's going to involve two important receivers of these nitrogen groups. One of which is alpha-ketoglutarate, which we already talked about. And the other one is glutamate. Okay, so alpha-ketoglutarate and glutamate both are able to receive ammonium, assuming it's there, to incorporate it into a precursor that can then be made into all the various amino acids. Not in us, though. That's true in most bacteria. A typical bacterium is able to synthesize all 20 amino acids. You know, we tend to say that bacteria are simpler organisms, and they are in terms of complexity of their body. They don't have a body, right? They don't have tissues. They have a single cell. But what goes on inside that cell biochemically is really complex. They have to do everything on their own because they don't go around eating other things like we do. So over the course of evolution, we have lost some of the enzymes that they still have and therefore we're not able to make everything we need, which is why we just get that in our diet or die. So alpha-ketoglutarate can receive ammonium ion, and that transforms it into glutamate. This reversible reaction is exactly the reverse of the way we described it in the previous chapter, right? Glutamate can be degraded, deaminated into alpha-ketoglutarate, like we said in the previous chapter. But now we're thinking about it in the reverse because we want to make an amino acid. We're not trying to get rid of one. Glutamate, once you have it, can also receive ammonium, and that will transform it into glutamine. So glutamate and glutamine are the two master nitrogenous compounds that then get rearranged into the other amino acids. And you see the on slide 5, the reaction that produces glutamine. Yeah. Yeah, they just didn't even bother. No, they did, right here. In parentheses, that's just a way of saying either NADH, DPH, or NADH. They should have been consistent, though, because they listed it differently in the previous chapter. But I actually didn't even mention the coenzyme. I'm glad you said that, because remember that the coenzyme is involved. It's what's handling, either receiving or delivering hydrogens, depending on which direction this is occurring. So, yeah, this is exactly the same enzyme that's doing this. It's just the reverse reaction. It's a completely reversible reaction. Okay. Slide 5 shows you glutamate being converted into glutamine. Like I said, that's the other important carrier of ammonium ion, which can, once it's incorporated into a larger molecule, an organic molecule, then can just be rearranged into the various other amino acids. If you're a bacterium, that is. We can do some of them we can't make. So glutamate, in the previous chapter I showed you this same exact reaction as well. But it was just shown as a one-stepper from glutamate to glutamine. It didn't show you the detail that's shown here, but this is exactly the same reaction. It just shows you that it actually happens in two steps rather than just one overall step. And so the intermediate here is an acyl phosphate. Well, why does that make sense? Because the acyl part of glutamate, which is its R group, recognize that its R group is an acyl, right? We've talked about acyls when we were talking about fatty acids, right? Well, this basically is a fatty acid. Glutamate has as its R group a fatty acid, right? So this is an acyl group, and it gets phosphorylated because ATP comes along and delivers one of its phosphates to that acyl group, onto one of the oxygens, in other words. So now we have an acyl phosphate intermediate that doesn't last very long because that phosphorylation really just allows then ammonia, which has been deprotonated from ammonium ion to make it back into ammonia, causes that to displace the phosphate group, and now you have ammonia on the carbon skeleton instead of phosphate, which leaves as inorganic phosphate. And what this new stuff now is called glutamine. So glutamine got its first amino group from that original equation involving alpha-ketoglutarate, right? Ammonium ion came, in other words, the previous slide. Ammonium ion came in, was latched onto alpha-ketoglutarate to make glutamate. That is now an amino acid. Alpha-ketoglutarate is not, right? There's no nitrogen in alpha-ketoglutarate. It is just an alpha-keto acid, like we talked about. It receives the ammonium to make it into glutamate, which is one of the 20 amino acids. But glutamate can now also receive, in the next reaction, another ammonium to make it glutamine. Glutamine is an amino acid because of this black part. That's what makes it the amino acid. And therefore, it's carrying one amino right here, but now it's carrying another amino group in its R group. And so this illustrates why glutamine is doing its job of carrying nitrogen in an organic compound rather than as raw ammonium ion. Once you have those two, then, like I said, glutamate and glutamine, they just get rearranged into the other amino acids. And that's what is summarized in slide 6. But this is not what's happening in you. This is what's happening in a typical bacterium that's able to make all 20 amino acids. The point here, though, is that although there are 20 amino acids, making them out of a few amino acids involves just a few major intermediates of other biochemical pathways, exactly like we described for the reverse process, degrading them, right? So oxaloacetate, alpha-ketoglutarate, pyruvate, 3-phosphoglycerate, phosphoenolpyruvate, erythrose 4-phosphate, and ribose 5-phosphate, all of which we've talked about before. Those were all intermediates of previously discussed biochemical pathways. Those are the intermediates that are used in making all 20 amino acids, using ammonium as raw material. But, like I said, we can't do all of these pathways. And the detail is not shown here. This is just showing you that these are the important intermediates for making all 20 amino acids. The color coding here, though, does show you that there are... Well, you can barely see it. You can see it better in the book, but there are some names here that are boldface. Those are the what we call the essential amino acids, and that simply means essential for humans specifically. The others are non-essential amino acids. So, like I said, the boldface doesn't show up very well on this screen, but if you look in your book, it's a lot more clear. The essential amino acids are called that because we can't make those de novo or from scratch. We have to get those from our diet. And that's really important because if you think about any given protein, it's going to be a mixture of a lot of different amino acids. few proteins are made of just one or two amino acids, right? If you think of it as a long ribbon of, or a string of beads, the beads are the amino acid. There's any given protein, since you're talking about tens or hundreds of beads, is going to use most or all of those 20 amino acids. So if there's any single amino acid that you're not able to make, you're in trouble if you don't get it in your diet, because if you're not able to make functional proteins, you're not going to be a successful organism, right? Even if all you can't make are enzymes, you're in trouble. But this includes all the other proteins as well. So the essential amino acids have to come from the diet, and that's why it's important to have a proper mixture of foods that you eat. Now, the essential amino acids are often found, well, if you have a food that has all essential amino acids, then we call that a protein that includes all essential amino acids, a complete protein. And many meats have complete proteins in them, which makes sense because we're basically eating things that are just like us, right? They have those proteins in them. There's plenty of plant-based foods that are incomplete proteins, which is why if you have a strictly vegetarian diet, you have it takes more work. You have to actually think about a vegetarian diet because, for instance, beans is a good source of protein, but it's an incomplete protein. Rice, another incomplete protein, but when you mix the two, there one of them has what the other one doesn't, and vice versa, so it ends up being complete. All right, but all 20 can be synthesized de novo in most bacteria. Slide 7 is a graph that shows you the number of steps in the pathways, and this is another chapter, just like the previous one, where we're not actually going to look at the details of most of these pathways. For one thing, we wouldn't have time even if I wanted to do it. But also, these pathways are highly variable from species to species. Not every species makes these amino acids identically. They're using the same pathways. That's in contrast to most of the pathways that we've studied here. You know, the main ones that we've looked at in detail, those are virtually identical in all species, like glycolysis, for instance, but not amino acid synthesis. But we also just do not have time to look at all the detail. Anyway, the steps in the pathways can vary drastically. They can be, some of these amino acids are very easily made simply by sticking one thing on to the precursor. Others require, as you see, up to 16 steps in a pathway. But the color coding here is between non-essential and essential. The trend that you should see here is that the non-essential ones tend to be the ones that have simple pathways. And that's true in us. It goes along with what I was saying before. In the course of our evolution as a species, we have lost many of the enzymes that the bacteria still have, and therefore we don't have all the enzymes necessary for these really long pathways. We have some of them still that we're able to make because we still have those genes, and therefore those short pathways we're able to operate, and therefore we're able to make these blue ones, these non-essential amino acids, out of other amino acids. But the ones that for the most part are very complex in terms of pathways require, therefore, since there's a lot of steps, a lot of different enzymes. We no longer have the genes to code for all of those enzymes, so we have to get those in our diet. All right, in slide 8, we're looking at three molecules that are important in this process. Pyridoxine is just the name for vitamin B6, one of many vitamins, and vitamins, of course, are essential nutrients because we can't make those usually either, so those have to come from the diet. But pyridoxine gets activated before it is actually useful to us, and it gets activated by being phosphorylated. Notice the phosphate group here. So the phosphorylated version, or the active form of vitamin B6, is pyridoxal phosphate, which is PLP. That is an important prosthetic group, so it's attached to enzymes and works as a cofactor, but it's a cofactor that's permanently attached. What kind of enzymes am I talking about what is occurring is transforming some basic amino acids into the other amino acids? How is that done by and large? Yes, and what's being transferred? If we're talking about amino acids, what is being transferred? We've already talked about this in the reverse process last chapter. The nitrogen group, which are aminos, right? So, what specific class of enzymes are we talking about? They are transferases, but what is the specific name for the class of enzymes? Transaminases is one name, and what's the other one? Amino transferases, exactly. There are multiple amino transferases because there are multiple different amino acids that need to be made out of other amino acids. But when you take the amino from one and put it onto another, you're transferring an amino group. So that's the enzymes that are major players in the production of these amino acids that we're able to make. Every one of those transaminases, though, or those amino transferases, interchangeable terms, features as a prosthetic group pyridoxal phosphate, PLP, because this part of the enzyme is what's able to receive the amino from the one that it's getting stripped of the amino. Okay? And you see that on the third variety of this molecule. Pyridoxal phosphate is activated, it's ready to go, it's part of the enzyme, and when the amino comes in and gets received by the pyridoxal phosphate, which you see right here in blue, that makes it into pyridoxamine phosphate, or PMP. All right? But then, of course, it doesn't stay there. This is just happening in the enzyme temporarily. Then it gets transferred onto whatever is receiving it to make it into one of the amino acids. So that's the general scheme. This is a major cofactor that is actually permanently attached to each enzyme, so it's a prosthetic group. Another major player in this game, in slide 9, is tetrahydrofolate. Tetrahydrofolate is shown in this picture, but notice the parentheses here, meaning that this part is repeated some number of times, so there's multiple varieties of it. But the basic components are shown by the three colors. You have a pteridine ring in black, a P-aminobenzoate in pink, and then a glutamate that has a certain length in parentheses repeated to make the overall tetrahydrofolate. Tetrahydrofolate is a versatile nitrogen carrier. A versatile carrier of single carbon groups in this process, because when you transamination, you know, shuffling these aminos around is not the only thing that's necessary to make some amino acid into some other amino acid. Sometimes you just have to mess with the R group by either taking, say, a methyl off or sticking a methyl on to make it into one of the other amino acids. All right, so it's not just transamination, it's also other kinds of things that need to be subtracted or added on. And tetrahydrofolate is a major player in this game. We see in slide 10, that's how you spell the name, by the way, if it wasn't obvious. This tetrahydrofolate molecule can exist in three different oxidation states: most reduced, intermediate, and most oxidized, as you see here. And depending on which oxidation state it's in, it can carry that single carbon unit that it's job to carry. Like I said in the last slide, its major job is a carrier of single carbons, single carbon units. But single carbons can be packaged with different things. So if it's a CH3 group, which is a methyl, that gets carried by the most reduced form of tetrahydrofolate. If it's a methylene, which remember is a CH2, but now the C is in the middle of a carbon skeleton, then that's the intermediate form. And then the most oxidized form can carry either a formal group, CHO, a formamino group, CHNH, or a methenyl group, CH double bond. And that's why I said it's versatile. This thing carries single carbons, but in several different forms. And therefore, there are really several different forms of tetrahydrofolate. Those several different forms are shown in slide 11, and I don't want you to memorize all this detail, but you can see that by receiving different things, you can convert one state into another, and they're all basically linked with each other. So, very versatile carrier of single carbon units. Now, tetrahydrofolate can carry methyl, like we just saw in the table. But it, for energetic reasons, it can't really deliver a methyl to something else. So it really acts as a receiver of methyl in cases in which, for instance, one amino acid has a methyl in its R group that needs to be removed in order to make that into a different amino acid, that methyl can be put on to tetrahydrofolate. But tetrahydrofolate can't really easily deliver that methyl to something else. Instead, it needs to be rearranged into a different form of tetrahydrofolate. So the job of methylating is mostly done by this major player shown in slide 12. This thing carries methyl groups and then delivers them to something else. And what we have here on the right is S adenosyl methionine, or adenosyl methionine, otherwise known as SAM. The S here is using one of the ways to distinguish between right and left-handed molecules. S and R are the two, right? Anyone know what the S stands for? Or the R? R stands for recto, which means right. S stands for sinistro, which means left. Sinister means left-handed. So S adenosyl methionine is SAM. Some people call it SAMI, SAM with an E after it in lowercase. But this book calls it SAM. Anyway, this is made out of methionine and ATP, as you see. What is methionine? Yeah, it's one of the 20 amino acids. But when methionine receives the adenosyl group from ATP, it becomes S-adenosyl methionine. ATP, remember, is a nucleotide, right? It's a nucleoside triphosphate. So as a nucleoside triphosphate, it includes a nitrogenous base, a sugar, and three phosphates. Well, that nitrogenous base and the sugar together are the nucleoside part of it, right? Without the phosphates, just the nitrogenous base and the sugar make up the nucleoside, and that nucleoside is called adenosine, right? Which is why the whole thing, when it has the three phosphates, is called adenosine triphosphate. Well, without the phosphates, just the blue stuff, that's adenosine. So this adenosine came from an ATP that's lost its phosphates, all three of them. All three phosphates get cleaved off. They actually get cleaved off as one orthophosphate and a pyrophosphate. So a phosphate and two phosphates stuck together. And then, as usual, pyrophosphate quickly gets broken into two orthophosphates. But the point here is that the ATP loses all three phosphates, just leaving the nucleoside to bind with the methionine to make S-adenosyl methionine, SAM. And this is the major carrier of methyl groups. The methyl group that I'm talking about is not the one in black. It's I'm sorry, that's not a methyl group anyway. It's the methyl group, the CH3, that's going to be delivered somewhere else is this one that's associated with the sulfur now. And the reason that this works so well, the reason it's so willing to, that SAM is so willing to give up this methyl, the CH3, is because it's involved with a sulfur that's has a positive charge. This sulfur wants to go back to forming just two bonds. And so it's very willing to give up this methyl. Much more willing than, for energetic reasons, than tetrahydrofolate would be, which is why this is the one that will methylate other things. Amino acids that need to receive a methyl to become a different amino acid use this guy. Slide 13 shows you part of the metabolism of this molecule. When S-adenosyl methionine works, it is going to methylate something else, and that something else is represented by RH here. That's just an amino acid, right? The R is part of the R group of an amino acid. When it gets methylated, that methyl comes from S-adenosyl methionine, and so S-adenosyl methionine gets demethylated in the process, and that leaves this now more happy sulfur in pink in the middle compound, which is S-adenosyl homocysteine, okay, because it's lost that methyl. Well, that gets then broken down into adenosine, which is being spit off. Not, you don't see the structure of it, but adenosine is one of the two things, and the other one is homocysteine, okay? Which is why when they were combined, they were called adenosyl homocysteine. Now, what is adenosine? Right, a nucleoside, the one I just talked about. Adenosine is adenine and ribose without the phosphates. So what's going to happen to it? Yeah, it's going to get rephosphorylated into an ATP. It's part of the adenosine pool. And the homocysteine is going to be further processed. You see that further processing right here in slide 14. This cycle basically goes back and forth between S-adenosyl methionine, SAM, and homocysteine for the purpose of receiving methyls and then passing them on to something else. All right? Homocysteine receives a methyl group on the lower left here to become methionine. Right? Methionine is converted, like we already talked about, with the help of the adenosine from ATP. Methionine gets transformed into S-adenosyl methionine, SAM, on the top. The two phosphate, or the three phosphates are removed, like I said. Then when S-adenosyl methionine gets used, meaning when it then transfers its methyl to something that needs it, that active methyl that's coming off is what gets put onto something else. That leaves S-adenosyl homocysteine, which with the help of water gets broken into adenosine, not shown here. Adenosine would be spit off, leaving homocysteine. The adenosine gets rephosphorylated into ATP. The homocysteine then can receive another methyl to complete the cycle and become methionine again. So this gets used over and over for all the amino acids that need to be methylated. And methyl is a pretty common group, by the way, in organic compounds in general, right? Because wherever you have a carbon at the end of a chain, or the end of a branch, just filling it with hydrogens makes a methyl group. Just capping it, that end carbon, with hydrogens to complete the valence of carbon, that makes a methyl group, which is why you see a lot of them in organic compounds. All right, we only have a few more slides left, and this is, like I said, we're skipping the details of the pathways, but the remaining slides have to do with some more discussion of how these pathways are controlled in general without using any specific examples. So A, B, C through Z here represents some biochemical pathway. including these pathways that lead to amino acid synthesis, which is why it's in this chapter. We've already kind of talked about this. This is simply feedback inhibition, right? This long unbranching pathway, no matter how many steps it has the purpose of producing ultimately Z, whatever Z is. Whatever amino acid in terms of this chapter Z is, you only need so much Z at the moment. So it's wasteful to make additional Z, right, when you don't need any more. Especially, it's not only wasteful in terms of energy, because ATP is used in these some of these steps, but it's also wasteful because the intermediates could be used to make other amino acids instead, right? So you don't want to make extra more Z than you need, and therefore Z, the final product, acts as an allosteric inhibitor of the enzyme that catalyzes the first step. That is the general scheme for feedback inhibition. Makes perfect sense, right? Because shutting down this first step means you don't bother making any of these intermediates, which would be wasteful since you don't need to transform them into the final product, since you don't need any more final product. So if you shut it down as early as possible, then you are as least wasteful as possible. This is just classic feedback inhibition, and by allosterically inhibiting it, what I mean is that Z, whatever it is, actually can bind to a receptor site on the enzyme itself, changing the conformation of that enzyme so that its active site no longer can receive the substrate, which is A. A will no longer fit in there, and therefore it won't be converted into B. The whole pathway shuts down. That's the simplest case. Some pathways, though, branch, as you've noticed throughout the term. And then slide 16 shows you a way that cells can take care of that situation. This one does use an actual example. Hydroxyethyl TPP is a branch point in a pathway. It doesn't matter what the specific example is. It's really what's going on that matters. But it's a fork in the road, basically. So this hydroxyethyl TPP can join with pyruvate to make either to go through a pathway that produces either valine or leucine, or if it takes the other fork in the road, I mean the other part, the tine of the fork, then it can combine with alpha-ketobutyrate to make isoleucine, a different amino acid. So this requires a little bit more sophisticated inhibition, feedback inhibition. Actually, I should say feedback control, because it's not simply inhibition. What you see happening here is that threonine gets converted into alpha-ketobutyrate, the thing that needs to be added to hydroxyethyl TPP in order to go down that rightmost road, right here. And there's an enzyme responsible for transforming threonine into alpha-ketobutyrate, obviously, and that is called threonine deaminase. And the only reason I'm giving these specific names is just so you can follow this example. I don't really want you to memorize these names. But that enzyme, threonine deaminase, is controlled by how much of these products of the overall major pathway are made. And as you see in pink, isoleucine inhibits threonine deaminase. That's appropriate, right? Because the leg of the fork that leads to isoleucine is the one that requires alpha-ketobutyrate. If you already have enough isoleucine on hand, it will start accumulating. If you're using it as fast as you're building it, then it's not accumulating and therefore will not bind to the enzyme. But the minute you have too much on hand, it stockpiles and it starts binding to the threonine deaminase. This by itself is simply what we looked at in the previous chapter. It's feedback inhibition. All right? But that same enzyme, threonine deaminase, gets activated by valine, which is one of the products of the other half of the fork in the road. Valine will start activating threonine deaminase, and that makes sense. Why? Exactly. This hydroxyethyl TPP can make all three of these things. Valine is part of one half. If this one half is being made in abundance, then it says shift this fork in the road to the other path, which leads to isoleucine. And it does that by valine saying there's already enough of this left pathway being produced. Let's turn up this right pathway. And it does that by making more alpha-ketobutyrate by activating the enzyme. Now, in 17, what we're looking at is something that's called enzyme multiplicity. Now, usually, any given step in a pathway is catalyzed by its own specific enzyme. But some steps in certain pathways can be catalyzed by any of multiple enzymes. Catalytically, they're identical, meaning they do exactly the same job, but it'll be two different enzymes, either of which can do the same job, two or more enzymes. This example just shows two. But as long as it's two or more enzymes that catalyze exactly the same reaction, then it qualifies as enzyme multiplicity. And since they are different enzymes, even though they work to do exactly the same thing, they are controlled differently because, the active site's the same, but the rest of the protein is different and therefore will have different allosteric sites on it. The allosteric sites are the places on the enzyme where an allosteric regulator will bind to either turn it up or turn it down. Right? And since they're different enzymes, they'll have different things that can bind to them to control those enzymes. So in this example, Y inhibits enzyme 2, X inhibits enzyme 1, but as long as they're not both inhibited, then this pathway will be allowed to go. This actually is this idealized example you wouldn't expect to see very often, right? Why is that? We have 25 minutes to figure it out. No, it's just think about feedback inhibition in general. Where would you expect Y to allosterically inhibit? But of which enzyme?
Enzyme 2.
Well, that's what's showing you is happening. But where would you expect it to happen? If the only thing shown were the blue arrows here? No. The first enzyme that leads only to Y, which is right here. If Y allosterically inhibits the enzyme that is represented by this first downward arrow, then the only thing it shuts off is production of Y, and the thing can still operate to make more X. X, similarly, you would expect to only allosterically inhibit this enzyme. Right? So, really, whether this exists anywhere or not, I don't know of a specific example, but the situation of multiplicity, enzyme multiplicity, does not require branchedness even. Right? You could have just a linear pathway with one overall final product, but multiple enzymes that any of which is able to catalyze that committed first step. But it could be controlled different ways. In other words, if that final product is things that you need for different processes within the cell under different situations, then you could have different things turn it on. Right? If this thing's present and you need this for that reason, it would turn it on. If another thing is present and you need this same product for a different reason, it will turn a different enzyme on to make that same final product. That's multiplicity. And you also, I don't even think I have any other picture. No, I don't. You also have a situation in which a single enzyme at a controlled step, which is usually that first step, the first irreversible step is usually what's controlled. You can also have the situation in which one enzyme is able to be controlled by several different allosteric regulators. And so each one of those regulators will exercise its influence. You know, and if we think about it in terms of inhibition, if you have a pathway that can lead to multiple different products, each one of those final products might be able to bind to that one enzyme and turn it down a bit. But it's not going to be totally turned off unless every product is already there and they all bind to the enzyme. So its regulation can get quite complex, but that's just these three slides illustrate the basics of enzyme regulation. And we've already talked about it a little bit, and I think we have in this course, haven't we? I certainly do in Cell Bio. I can't remember anymore. But that is the course. So the most important thing now is, other than studying and finishing up the homework, is to remember that the final is not at 9 o'clock, right? If you show up late to the final, you give up your right to take the retake, assuming that you already have that right because you've given me the survey. So get here at what time is it? What time's the final? 7:30, right? 7:30, yeah. So be fully awake, fully knowledgeable, and hopefully do well.